Welcome to McFly's Movie House, a weekly podcast that delves into cinema's hidden gems, celebrating forgotten classics and emerging filmmakers while fostering an inclusive film narrative. I'm your host, Marta Georgievich, and I'm excited to have you over. Hello, hello, and welcome back to McFly's Movie House. I'm your host, Marta McFly, and we've got a fantastic episode today. I'm here to chat about a film that I saw for the first time last year, and it just immediately became a 5 out of 5. I was obsessed. I couldn't stop thinking about it. And that's Frank and Eleanor Perry's 1968 film, The Swimmer, a incredibly bizarre drama that straddles the line between being an old Hollywood film and an exciting and new member of Hollywood's new wave movement that had just emerged. It's a movie that depicts the fading American dream while also illustrating the suppression of reality, the passage of time, and the fear that comes with all of that. So the leading role is immaculately played by Burt Lancaster, and we're going to get into that later on. We have to. But there's a lot to chew on and analyze here. And the guest I picked today has an interest in movies that tackle that sort of American suburban lens. He's endlessly talented both as a film content creator and his work as a filmmaker as well. He's run his own film production company for the last 7 years, while over on the content creation space, he's known for celebrating physical media and its importance and keeping it alive. And he has over 3,000 movies in his collection. So I'm beyond honored to welcome Brian Starr to the podcast. Hello, my friend. How are you?
Wow. That was so nice.
Thank you.
How's it going? I'm doing great. This is a dream to be here in this exact scenario, because we've been talking about it for a little while, and it's real, and I'm excited for you, and just as excited to be here. So thank you.
Like I said, I adore this movie, and I remember you were, I think, the first person that I reached out to immediately after watching it. I was obsessed. And then I know that you got the physical copy of the Grindhouse releasing before I did.
Yes.
Right there. But what was one thing that stuck out to you about the movie? And I mean, do you like it after watching it?
Yeah. This was I was nervous because you talked so much about this to the point where, like, then it became the subject of this episode. And I was like, oh my gosh, I hope I like it. And yes, of course. It's just a delight. It starts out just so, like, there's something up, but at the same time, you're just like, you're happy, which, of course, that kind of changes a little bit. And it's just wonderful. Yeah. And Burt Lancaster, like,
what?
he looks like this the entire movie.
It's insane. Yeah. It's crazy. Awesome. Well, before we properly get into it, I explain the breakdown, I always ask my guests to tell me what they've been watching lately and what they recommend we check out. But with you, I want to do something kind of different. So I'm wondering, what recent blind buy of physical media has blown you away?
Yeah, fantastic. So actually, I have two right here. What are the chances? But
imagine.
This one, everyone has mentioned, is an incredible film. A more modern film. I bought it because of the steelbook. It's a beautiful steelbook, but it's the movie Prey, which is the prequel to Predator. And this was my first time watching it. So I watched it, obviously, after I purchased it. And yeah, of course, everyone's right. It's wonderful. Just so good. And then this one, if we ever can talk about whodunits in the future, this is one on the top for sure. But it is The Last of Sheila, the only movie that Stephen Sondheim ever wrote. Of course, he's known for so much other things, but this is the only movie that he was involved with. One of the greatest whodunits ever.
Wow, I've never even heard of that. The Last of Sheila. No.
Raquel Welch is in it. Oh. Ian McShane as a young guy. I've never seen Ian McShane, younger than 50, probably.
Yeah.
wonderful. Yeah. So
Raquel Welch was an icon.
And she is still in this. Yeah. And I specifically picked this because I know you and your audience would totally get a kick out of this. Yeah. So I was, it was recommended by, not to me, obviously, but it was recommended by Ryan Johnson, who did some whodunits, of course. And I was like, yeah, you know what? Sounds great. Sondheim is involved. This was like, I'm pretty sure when he passed away. And that's why I think it was brought up. Yeah. And it just kind of sat there forever, as most blind buys do. And then finally got into the kick of whodunits, watched it, and was like, I should have watched this ages ago. It's wonderful.
Amazing. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm definitely going to check that out and then text you my thoughts.
Yes. Perfect.
But to break down this episode here today for you and for those who are listening, what we're going to be doing is giving a brief description of the plot. Maybe highlight some interesting facts, that sort of thing. And then we can give a further breakdown of the film in depth and our thoughts. And for those of you who haven't watched it, I mean, there's going to be spoilers. So how does that sound for you?
Yeah, no, that's perfect. That's great.
Amazing. So I'm going to quickly read out the short Letterboxd description of the plot. It says, well-off ad man Ned Merrill is visiting a friend when he notices the abundance of backyard pools that populate their upscale suburb. Ned suddenly decides that he'd like to travel the 8 miles back to his own home by simply swimming across every pool in town. Soon, Ned's journey becomes harrowing. At each house, he is somehow confronted with a reminder of his romantic, domestic, and economic failures. That, to me, is pretty on the money. What do you think?
Yeah, and you know what? Spoilers already. I went into this movie completely blind, right? I didn't read a single thing. I just, you told me to watch it and I did. And that's pretty much how it went. And so even in that description right there kind of gives away the mystery that I experienced within the first 5 minutes. That's a good description for sure though.
And that's a good point to bring up, because I'm going to be asking you along the way when things started cluing in for you, because you went into it blind, so that's perfect. But I think it's important to also mention that The Swimmer is actually based on a 1964 short story by John Cheever, which appeared in an issue of The New Yorker. It's very short, actually. I think it took me like half an hour to read. Nice. But then husband and wife duo Frank and Eleanor Perry decided to adapt it, and there was a bidding war for the material, and they eventually mortgaged everything to pay for the rights for this movie. Everything. Eleanor wrote the screenplay within 3 months, and then Frank directed it. And the film was produced by Sam Spiegel, who produced some like crazy widely acclaimed films like Lawrence of Arabia, for example. And he loved the script. And even though nobody else in Hollywood wanted to touch it due to the content matter, he was like, let's go. So principal photography was done. Perry was supposed to film some transition scenes, and he showed the rough cut to Spiegel, who fired him, and he discarded a third of the footage. Did you know this? It's crazy.
I knew there was some issues, and I know like the there is a guest director on this project that blew me away. Yes. So yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So then, I mean, it just gets worse, which is crazy to think about. But interestingly enough, at least, like you said, there was that one director, but I heard that two additional ones were potentially brought on. But most notably, it was Sidney Pollack, as you know. And that's because he was Lancaster's friend. They were buddies. So he did some reshoots with a different cinematographer. I think his name was Michael Nebbia. Like the horse race, which we'll get into, or some of those more dreamlike sequences. That was all Pollack. And it's strange because I think Pollock's style is different to Perry's, but it somehow only adds to this fever dream like disarray, to me at least. He also directed the scene, for example, with Janice Rule, who's Ned's mistress. And she wasn't even in the first cut of the film. It was a different actress, Barbara Loden. So what do you think of this? What do you make of Pollock's reshoots? And could you tell that those were scenes from a different filmmaker?
I couldn't. I only knew that he reshot the mistress scene, or if that was even a part of the original film. So I didn't know he was more like the dreamy thing. And that's only because, again, I'm so blind into this story that I just went along with it. I was like, yeah, no, this makes sense, because nothing, there's no answers. No one is just being direct. I was so frustrated with people. Like, just tell them. just don't like dance around it. Obviously that's on purpose, but yeah, so I was just like, yep, nope, that's, this all makes sense to me.
This is all one person. Yeah. But I do think that Frank and Eleanor Perry were a perfect fit for this film because it really is unique and they brought a lot of their previous experience to it. So Frank had experience in theater. I think he worked as a Broadway theater manager at the New York Theater Guide. And then Eleanor, meanwhile, she was the big ticket item here because she worked on the screenplay and she had degrees in psychiatry and social behavior. And she already wrote her own numerous plays and novels. But I think that these strengths really contributed to capturing the human interactions and the feelings that can be related to so many people, right? Some of the stuff that Ned goes through can be applied. And actually, there's an interview in the New York Times in 1970 where Frank actually shared, "My films are actors' films. Films of human relationships. I never think, how can I dazzle the audience with my camera? I want to dazzle them with the truth." So that's it to me. They portray a truth and the fears that so many people have in adulthood or middle age, right? Where you try to suppress that passage of time or that superficiality. I mean, would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Isn't there, and I don't know if you were planning on getting into this, but there was a phrase on the original poster that yes. said something like, if you talk about the swimmer, will you talk about yourself?
Talk about yourself. Yes, yes. That was actually the next point I was going to make. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, yes, I mean, absolutely. There, even today, like in my own life, I'm watching this and I'm just like, this is such a like different class of living. Mm-hmm. And it's a really great look into that as well, because you're seeing so many different characters and so many different classes, you know, from the top to the bottom. And yeah, and you're kind of watching it like, all right, where am I fitting here? No, that makes sense.
Perfect. Well, that's actually a perfect segue with that tagline. Are you ready for the proper breakdown now of the movie scene by scene?
Yeah, that's perfect. Let's do it.
Amazing. Amazing. So the film opens in an interesting way to me, at least. And it's something that I, weirdly enough, kind of like you, accepted right off the bat. And yeah. only after a rewatch was I like, oh, okay, that's kind of strange. So it opens with the credits flashing across the screen. And then you see the first person point of view of someone just walking through a forested area. And then Ned Merrill, our lead, he emerges and he's barefoot and just in swim trunks. And he'll be wearing those swim trunks throughout the entire movie, as you said. And I discovered that actually 17 pairs of swim trunks were used, 12 of which had to be discarded for like wear and tear. Crazy, right? Yeah. Like,
yeah, that makes sense.
And the role was a ballsy move for Lancaster. And we'll get into that later on, but he was in his 50s, I believe, when he took on this role, right? And he was already considered a Hollywood heavyweight, very strong, confident man, just physically. And it was at a time when being a macho man was a big deal, right? Mm. So to be in your swim trunks for the majority of all this, like, good for him. Yeah. And his role we'll chat about more, but he really does come off as that sort of narcissistic and fearless guy. So to see him crumble into that vulnerability later on, it's a difficult line to toe. I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. He was, again, I knew nothing. I had no idea he was going to be in this swimsuit the entire time. And you're just watching him and he's talking to his friends in the first scene, the first pool that he that he finds himself at. He's talking to his friends and they're, and this is kind of like when I was like, oh, there's something going on. And he looks almost 10 years younger than his friends, even though they're all the same age in the story. And I think that's definitely on purpose, but I was I had to look up how old he was. And I was like, wow, he's in his 50s. He looks fantastic. 17.
It's crazy.
Did you say 17 pairs?
17,
That's great.
Did you know he said that this was also his favorite film performance he's done? I read that somewhere.
I did. Yeah, I love that.
Wild, yeah. But yeah. So anyways, as you were saying, so he comes out of these woods and he enters the first yard. That's his neighbors. They're a husband and wife duo. And they're nursing a hangover from the night before. So they're just lounging around. And as you said, he just immediately shows up. Weirdo. And immediately takes a dump in their pool. They offer him a drink. And then two other friends show up. They catch up. And it appears that Ned has been MIA for a while, which is, again, probably when you started cluing in. And he keeps telling his friends he's well. Where's his wife? She's at home. Where are the girls? They're playing tennis. And their neighbors tell him that some of the surrounding neighbors of the area have now pools built in their backyards. So Ned has this idea, let's swim from pool to pool. And he tells his friends he's going to do this, and they're puzzled. They're like, why are you doing this? And he names this trek the Lucinda River after his wife. Is there anything you want to add to this first scene?
This is a YouTube video. This is, I'm swimming all the way home. You know, I'm swimming by hitting every of my neighbor's pool. Like, what a concept. This
right? It's like a TikTok challenge or something. Yeah. Yeah,
that's exactly it. Yeah.
Totally.
It was so goofy. And there's like, there's so many like random things of him just like looking up in the sky. Like he is so, in this moment, he is so high on life.
Yeah.
And there's like, it's now that I've watched the entire movie, it's very clear that he is delusional for very good reasons to be, for sure. And yeah, he's just like looking out and is like, yeah, I'm going to swim all these pools. And there he goes.
Crazy guy. So I think it's important to note as well that The Swimmer was shot over 8 weeks. And it was shot in continuity. And this wasn't overly common at the time. But the approach here is clever. And that's why I want to highlight it, because it highlights the increasing exhaustion that took a toll on Lancaster's body as he's like literally as he's swimming across these pools. And we see that fatigue as time goes on. He gets scars. I don't know if you notice, like around the sides of his face. This all sort of contributes and reflects his mental state. And Lancaster actually wasn't a swimmer at all. He had to train for months and he took swimming lessons so he could look like somebody who was comfortable swimming. And this came as such a shock to me because he looks like a dolphin when he dives into that water, does he not?
Well, I was going to kind of make fun of that dive though, because I think the first dive actually, it looks like a belly flop. Like the very first one, I'm pretty sure I kind of laughed out loud. I was like, it's very, especially him swimming, you're absolutely right. Like it is smooth, but that first dip, instead of like going down, it's very just like, it had to have hurt him. And I think about like when I was a kid and I took swimming lessons and could not dive and to this day cannot dive. So I can't like fully make fun of him, obviously, because I don't think I could do any better. But I did, when I read that fact about him not being a swimmer, I was like, okay, I think that kind of makes sense. But still, it looks great. He always does.
Absolutely. But anyway, so back to the story. But that's so funny you should mention that, because I'm not a swimmer personally. I just do the butterfly constantly. So for me, he was a pro. But anyways, his friends kind of give him this weird look when he says this. And again, you pick up on so many of these looks upon rewatch, as you were saying, once you know, you're like, oh my God, there's so many clues throughout. But so off he goes to the next few pools. And the next one on the list is another couple. They apparently have the newest pool in their neighborhood, and they're quick to mention it as well. They have something like, I think it was like the best filtration system money can buy, blah, blah, blah. They brag. And I thought the touch to include those super specific terms when it comes to filtration systems was hilarious, because that's totally something that would happen in middle-aged suburbia, right? Like something that a man would boast about. But is there anything else here that stuck out to you from the scene? It was pretty quick, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the all the bells and whistles couple, and I think she even said something like, next year we're gonna get all the accessories for his lawnmower, and yeah, 99.99.99% of all materials were filtered out of that pool, and you could drink it. It was better than their drinking water, is what she said.
Yeah.
So they were very much the I don't know if they're the keeping up with the Joneses type. They might be the Joneses that you always have to keep up with because they got it all. In fact, she wants to travel more, and he's like, "Why do you want to travel? We have everything we need right here." Mm-hmm. That's a good thing to pick up on.
I didn't even pick up on that. That's very, very clever. So he finishes with this pool. He goes on to the next. And this is, for me, first time around where I got the inkling of, okay, something's wrong. He jumps into that pool immediately, as he's been doing. And when he comes out, an older woman is staring at him. And she says something like, "Who gave you permission to use the pool?" And we discover that she's the mother of one of Ned's old friends, who asks where he is. And we discover that his friend had some illness and he was hospitalized and he passed away. And Ned had no idea, even though this guy's allegedly a good friend of his. So this woman makes a point to tell him he wasn't there for her son. And can you just get the hell off my property? What do you think about this when you were watching it for the first time? What was going through your head at this point?
Still delusional, this guy. So he comes out of the water. She says, "Who gave you permission? Or why do you think you have permission?" And he's just like, "I'm Ned Merrill." Just answers with, "I'm Ned Merrill," as if that matters. And and then absolutely. Like, clearly something is up because she does not want him there. He asks how he's doing. You know, did he get better? And even though she doesn't say he died, it's very clear that he should know the answer to that question, to not even bring that up. And so, this is a moment when you're like, something is up. There is a passage of time that is missing from this guy's memory. And and that shakes him a little bit as he moves on from there.
Totally. And that's a good point that you mention of just why does this matter, or the fact that he's Ned Merrill. I feel like that's such a theme of this movie, the undertones of why does any of this matter? Like, why are you putting such an importance on this? I like that. But so he runs off, and then we get this bizarre little segment where he looks frazzled as he's in the woods between neighboring properties, and he sees that black stallion, literally a horse in the distance, that comes towards him. And what does Ned do? He decides to race the horse. Just such obvious symbolism here. And they do, and he loses. And I don't know about you, but this to me was just such a visual clue of Ned trying to hold on to his glory days, basically, thinking he can outrun a horse, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And the whole time I'm like looking and noticing that he's barefoot. And I think about my feet running in grass as fast as a horse. And it goes back to how old is this guy? He's in his 50s. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't even see, I mentioned that at the start. I'm like, he's in these shorts this entire movie, but I didn't even think of that in that specific scene, running at full speed and just barefoot. Oof.
Yeah.
Not going to happen. But there's a motif we see that's repeated here, and it grows and grows so much as the movie progresses. And I was reading that Cheever, who wrote the short story, he noted this in the writing process, his idea of this story that started off as a reflection of the myth of Narcissus. And if you know the myth, right, with Narcissus being so obsessed with his own beauty and reflection in the water, so is Ned. He's not obsessed with the reflection in these pools, but he's more so chasing or swimming towards a reflection that's long gone, of this idyllic life that's gone. I mean, would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's really good. I didn't read that. Let me get my light back on. There we go. That is really good. That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, he's definitely not obsessed with his image, I would say, even though I would say Burt Lancaster probably was very obsessive during this movie. I think he had to be because of how much he shows. But the character very much is stuck when life was good and continuously trying to chase that. And obviously later we find out it's going to be tough.
Yeah, exactly. So we have this weird, I guess, horse chase scene. And then Ned says bye to the horse, literally. And off he goes to the next pool where there are some youths in the water. We later discover that they're around 20-ish, I think. But so here he asks them where their parents are. They're not home. And again, we see more inklings of, I guess, this passage of time that's actually happening. Because we discover that Ned hasn't seen these people in a while. And they ask how his daughters are. And the general gist of things, if they're asking, is that his daughters are slightly older than these children here, right? And one of the girls there, Julie, played by Janet Langard, who's incredible, we discover that she used to babysit his daughters. And here we see some hints that Ned is smitten with this now grown up Julie. He's taken aback that she's an adult. And he asks her why she stopped coming to babysit. And she gives that simple answer of like, well, I wasn't needed anymore, which makes us think, oh, well, his daughters grew up. And here Ned says something particular. He waves off the suggestion. I don't remember what he says exactly, but he tells her she can keep babysitting if she wants. And she's confused by that. So were the gears turning for you here even more? What was going on?
So weird. Yeah. He literally is like, what are you doing Sunday or what are you doing Friday?
Yeah.
Come on over. You know, babysit the kids. And it's very clear that these kids don't need babysitting anymore. And I never really figured out the age of these kids. Clearly too old for a babysitter. And there's another moment too where he's looking at the girl and he's just like, you know, how old are you? And then her brother comes in and he's like, you know, you used to be this big. And it's so funny because it's very clear he has memory loss in this moment, and no one's pushing it any further. Of they're just like, oh, silly old this guy. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, it's very clear that he's absolutely delusional. I think even they say, you know, where are the daughters? And he again says they're playing tennis and they freak out. They're like, well, they should have told us. So it's very clear that they're gone somewhere at this point. I expected the worst. And it was at this moment where I expected something pretty bad. Not necessarily death, because obviously they're still alive, but something is up. And no one is being clear at all.
Which is weird. But it almost kind of speaks to that sort of suburban, I guess, trope of pushing things under the rug or not talking about the actual problems at hand. So it makes sense, but kind of, I know what you mean. You're just like, can you just tell him what's going on? So he tells them what he's doing, that he's swimming the Lucinda River. And two of them think he's crazy, except for Julie, who loves the idea, and she wants to go along with him. Ned invites her. She tags along, and they jump in the pool. Hopefully now it's a better jump. And they swim a lap, and away they go. And from there, we watch them walk to their next destination through the woods again to get to the next yard or lawn. And we get more of that swirling theme song. I can we pause for a second? Because I love that theme song so much. It's so romantic. It's so haunting. What are your thoughts on the theme? I forgot to mention it. It's at the start of the movie, too, when we first hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Marvin Hamlisch, I think, was the composer. Yep. I think. To me, it fits and it doesn't. And I think that's kind of on purpose. To me, it is happy when it shouldn't be. And mysterious and very dreamy. That scene in particular, and I know we're about to say what's about to happen, but when she's talking, beautiful. Like the shots are unlike, it makes sense that this was kind of like, you said it was like kind of inspired like French New Wave. Is that what you were saying earlier?
Maybe I could have, but I can see how I would think that too. It does have that sort of swirling nature definitely.
It was unnatural and so unique and and the music fit for sure. Absolutely.
I was obsessed with it. The first time I watched The Swimmer afterwards, I looped that song for days on end, and I still do. And so, yeah, like you said, that was done by Marvin Hamlisch. Yeah, that was his name. And he did not have previous experience scoring films at the time. He got the job actually playing piano at one of Spiegel's parties. And he impressed him so much. And he heard the story of Spiegel producing The Swimmer. So he went home, he read the short story, because that's all he had at this point, by Cheever, and he came up with a theme song, and he went back to Spiegel, and he played it, and Spiegel loved it, immediately wanted to use it, and Hamlisch was in his early 20s at the time, and this just kind of jump-started his career. He said he wanted to capture the sound of water in the theme and the rippling of water musically. And he said he was inspired by tragedy as well, as romance is, just drenched in tragedy, romantic tragedy, I guess. But crazy how he got that gig, eh?
Yeah, just casually playing piano. And like, yeah. was he a guest or was he...
He was just hired to play piano. That's all I know. Spiegel was known to be like a very in charge man. So if he saw something that he liked, he would immediately just be like, "Listen, you, want you." Yeah. But so back to the story. They're walking through these woods. Yes, this is where we stop. They're walking through the woods, and we discover that Julie had a massive crush on Ned when she was his babysitter. And she goes into detail here. Ned, I'm sure, is overjoyed, or he looks overjoyed. His ego probably loves this. And before things get weird, let's say, they come across their next destination, another pool. And this is a pool party filled with guests. One guest in particular, I don't know if you know about this, the guy that's floating in the water, he looks drunk. That's John Cheever, the author, in a cameo.
That's awesome.
Did you know that?
I knew he had a cameo. I didn't know that was him.
Didn't know where.
And that's really funny. That's awesome.
I think that Frank and Eleanor Perry as well are in that scene. Don't quote me on that. It's one of the party scenes that there's some of the guests there, but it's cool. Yeah, it's just a nice nod.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Ned's talking to the folks at the party, and he's introducing Julie. And here we get another hint that something's up, because I think one of the guests offers Ned a job opportunity. And Ned kind of waves him away. Right? Am I missing anything there?
Yeah, that's kind of like right at the tail end of that party. Before that, I'm pretty sure that's when he bumps into his mistress that he sees later. Or he bumps into someone.
Yeah.
And says, this is our babysitter. And she says, you know.
She scowls. Right,
well, get out of here.
And
he's like, no, she's with me. And in this very like sense. But then... Yeah. She asks about, in some way he brings up his wife, and that lady got very upset that he did that. And kind of like side-eyed the girl as if this is an affair or something. And so that was another weird moment at that pool there. She like very upset, and Bert is just as happy as can be, just talking with everybody, moving along. but yeah, then he runs into this guy who gives him an opportunity, and it's as if Bert is just continuously moving. He never stops and has full conversations with these people, and that's where that frustration comes in, where no one is just putting it out there and saying anything, and I don't think they have the time, because he's just moving from one couple to another, giving his compliments and then getting out of there before it can get any serious. And the guy offering the job is not happy that he kind of walked away from that.
Mm-hmm. And you're so right. That is a really good point to make, that he really doesn't give people a chance to elaborate on things. Because I think that's what happens in that scene too. This guy's talking to him, trying to help him, and he just grabs Julie and they just go dump into the pool again. They just go swimming. And the next thing you know, they're out to their next destination. But before they come across another pool, they discover a horse track with those bars that horses jump over. What are those called? Yeah. Why am I blanking on this?
I don't know what they're called, but they're like, training for galloping
jumping bars.
And jumping. And that's exactly what they're doing.
So we see these things, and they're jumping over them together in this montage, I guess. And then Ned decides to jump over one more by himself as Julie watches him. And he does this jump and he lands funny and he injures himself because he's not a young buck anymore, even though he tries to play it off. Now, what's interesting there is, I mean, that scene fits so perfectly into the movie, but I discovered that Lancaster was actually injured in real life at this point. So they wrote this in, so when he's limping afterwards, it makes sense and there's a reason for that. And I found that fascinating because, yeah, like I said, it fits in so perfectly with the story of a man who has this big ego. He's trying to show off for a younger girl, right? Like, it just works.
Yeah. So he was really injured. Like, that's like, was the limp for the movie or was the limp?
Limp was IRL.
Yeah. I mean, it looks real. Like, he's,
yeah.
It looks like it hurt. And again, it goes back to him running with a horse, just like landing barefoot and jumping over these things. And they did a lot. That's a montage that is multiple shots over and over and over, different angles. So I can't imagine being that age and doing that. So it makes sense that he's in real life injured.
Yeah. I mean, some of the visuals in this segment I fell in love with as well. This was the other one, as we mentioned, that was one of those scenes that was reportedly done by Sidney Pollack. And that kaleidoscopic element of Julie's face and Ned jumping, I just found that so beautiful and dreamlike. I mean, what did you think at this point?
She's stunning. Yeah. She like the shots. And I was getting worried because movies made at different times did different things, and I thought, oh no, here's a 50-year-old with a 20-year-old, and she's already professed her love for him.
Yep.
There's the dreamy eyes. Okay, let's keep watching.
I was bracing myself at this point. I'm like, please, 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 please. But so before they get to that next pool, they decide to sit down. Ned can rest his leg, you know, because he's injured. And Julie reveals some inappropriate incidents that were happening to her with men at her workplace. And Ned is disturbed by this news and he declares that he wants to protect Julie. And you're right. This is where things get weird. He touches her stomach and tries making a move on her. Thank God she rebuffs him and runs away. What were your thoughts on this scene?
It's what needed to happen. Obviously, I was rooting for her when she bolted. But there's two things in there that this is the change. This is the shift for him. And it's she mentions a boyfriend. So she has a boyfriend. And that's probably not going to stop him. I don't think it has before. But then the realization comes, and I think it's really brilliant, where so earlier she mentions stealing one of his shirts when she was in love with him, and she would wear it when she would do her studies. And in this moment, he has this realization on his head, on his face, and asks her, do you still have the t-shirt? And she says no, because at this point she has no feelings for him. I don't know why she went with him. I do think that she is a dreamer of some kind. So she loved the idea, but it was not to do anything with him. In that moment is when he realized, oh, this is not how it usually goes. But it was in that moment when she says she doesn't have the shirt anymore. I think this is the tipping point in the movie for him.
Yeah, that's a really good observation. Now that you mention it, I would agree with you. So she runs away and then he limps away by himself. And he's heading now towards the property owned by other neighbors yet again. But en route to the actual house, he has to walk along a driveway. And he encounters a black chauffeur whom he mistakes for his neighbor's previous employee. And this exchange just perfectly shows, yet again, this affluent neighborhood and these people that are just so clueless to their prejudices, just completely unaware. And as is Ned, he's unaware that he's offending this man who's trying to keep it together and not show his own anger, right? And there's one line that was originally in the script, and I wish they kept it in, but it's when Ned apologizes for mistaking him for someone else, and the chauffeur replies, "It's okay. Sometimes you all look alike to us, too." Did you know about this?
That's great. No, I didn't. It was obvious that, because he says, like, "I don't know why I would have mistaked you for..."
Yeah.
I forget the guy's name. And I was like, what do you mean, man?
It's so bad.
That's a funny response, though. That's... Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like that must have been studio interference or something, but there you go. That's just another example of Eleanor Perry's just like wit that comes across in that script. So he gets out of the car and he goes to the backyard of these neighbors who are nudists, and they're seated at this table. And to fit in, Ned also takes off his trunks to say hello. And before he approaches them, we get a hint that something else is up, because the husband remarks to his wife that he hopes Ned doesn't ask them for money again. I'm sure at this point, were you starting to realize there was maybe something with his business or...
Yeah. So the pool party before, someone mentions, I hate what happened to you. Something not exactly, like, definitely not clear. And then it's in this moment where obviously something happens with finances. And so, yeah, the pieces are coming together. But it's very clear in this moment that he probably doesn't have money.
Nothing. Exactly.
Yeah.
But so interestingly, he doesn't ask for money. He actually tells the woman, I thought this was interesting, he tells the woman to put him down for her charity event, which obviously costs money, right? And he forces her to put his name down, and he goes to use their pool. And then immediately after, she crosses off the name. Then he goes into the next yard, and there he sees a young boy selling lemonade. And he gets some from him, and he promises to pay him back the next day. I felt so bad for this kid, because at this point, you know that kid's not going to get that money, right?
Like, yeah, no.
Not even the 50 cents.
Absolutely not. No, yes, exactly.
So bad. So the kid, poor kid, he takes him to his pool. We discover that his parents are away and the pool is empty. The kid doesn't know how to swim. So with his parents away, there's obviously no need for water. And so Ned decides to pretend to swim across the pool, and he says he'll teach the kid to swim, and they do it together. The reason why I point all this out is because we get one of the most, in my opinion, telling quotes in the movie. And this is where things for me were just like, okay, now everything makes sense. He tells the kid, "If you make believe hard enough that something is true, then it's true for you." Mm. What did you think at this point?
Yeah. Well, I felt terrible for the kid, because his parents, I think, were split, because mom was on a honeymoon. The boy was very free of sharing all of the tea on his parents. And the poor kid was just left there with a maid all by himself. Didn't even have a pool to chill around. So I was already just like, I was feeling bad for the kid. And then... maybe just a little confused at the why, because he stayed there for a while, and there's even a moment where he leaves and then comes back. Confused at why he stayed there a little bit longer than most places. Like, he was giving promises to this kid of bringing money back and coming over and playing with the kids, riding bikes, I don't know if he like really wanted to stay in that moment before things got darker, because the pool, to me, being empty also symbolized the fall of this entire thing for him, because even though he did cheat and pretend to swim, it wasn't a real connection to the water for him. So Yeah, so there was like confusion, but there's also a little bit of understanding of,
yeah,
of this pivotal moment.
That's interesting that you bring up that he stayed the longest at this pool, because I've seen the movie now twice and that didn't register with me. But there are some hints that we'll hear later on with his daughter, something about a car accident that we'll get into. So it makes me wonder if maybe perhaps his daughter's passed away and he feels this connection to this boy. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or because, again, he keeps saying that his daughters are of a certain age, and they're clearly not. Yeah, maybe it's, I wish my kids were still this little.
Yeah, exactly. Could be, yeah. So he then goes, after he goes and comes back to this boy, he goes to the next pool. And this one is, I think, an even bigger pool party and even more raunchy than the last one. This scene also marks Joan Rivers' film debut as an actress.
Crazy.
The Perrys were her husband's friends at the time, and the part was written for her. Honestly, dude, like, I didn't even recognize her when I was watching this. Did you?
No, like, I knew she was in it, and the whole time I'm just like, okay, where is she? Where
waiting.
Is she? And not until someone says her name, which is Joan.
Joan.
In the movie, I was like, that, there's no way, because obviously I grew up with her when she's older. And,
yeah, same.
Yeah, no, couldn't. I was blown away for sure.
Same, same. So he's at this party, and the woman whose house it is, she's not nice to Ned at all. We discover that Ned wasn't the kindest neighbor to her in the past, but so she lets him mingle. And he's mingling. He goes for his swim. And then when he comes out of the water, he spots a hot dog cart, it was, I believe. And we discover that this cart belonged to him. And he's distressed and he's confused as to why they have this cart, because he wants it back. I think he even built it himself. And from there, that woman appears again along with her husband. And we discover that Lucinda sold the cart at like an estate sale, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. This is kind of like, yeah, there's money troubles. This is kind of the clue to, there's some money troubles. Lucinda was doing everything she could to stay afloat. And again, he's oblivious to it all. It's very clear that there's a couple of years that are just missing from memory for this guy.
Totally. And then I think he even tells the husband, like, he'll buy the cart back. But again, much like the lemonade, that's not going to happen. And this guy lets him know that that's not going to happen in front of all these people. And they get into a bit of a scuffle. And he pushes Ned to the ground, who's defeated and again, just limps away. It's just, this is the point where even against my own judgment, I started feeling a bit bad for him. Then I'm like, why do I feel bad for him? Because he's not really the greatest guy either.
Yeah.
It's just, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it was so awkward watching this because everyone was judging him every single moment. Even the people that seemed way more friendly for him, there was just always a bit of judgment. And it didn't help that he was completely clueless. So he was putting himself in these moments of awkwardness of like, hey, old chum. I'll go to your event, put me down. When in reality, he can't afford it. He can't afford to just send a check. He says this multiple times where he's just I'll send you a check. He can't, and everyone knows it but him. It's crazy.
Exactly. So that's a good point with the check. You're right. It does happen multiple times. But so he doesn't know what to do. He's fallen to the ground. He gets up. He leaves. And next up is another pool. And this pool, we discover, is owned by Shirley, an actress who happens to be Ned's ex-mistress. And she, along with everybody else so far, is not pleased to find him there. And here we get some information about their relationship. Ned is, again, as you're saying, very confused by how much time has passed. He tries to make a move on her, but she is just not wanting anything to do with him. And for me, at least, you could really tell that she loved him once. But Ned, sadly, is just an awful dude. And here we get some interesting background information as well. It was actually on the special features of this, but Shirley was played by Janice Rule. as you know. And during the original shoot, her part was played by Barbara Loden. And this scene was reshot by Sydney Pollack, as we were saying. And it carried a much different tone to the original scene with Loden. So from what I understood, the scene with Loden played out with Lancaster, it was a lot more physical. I believe even her swimsuit top comes off at one point when she dunks in the water. And Loden's husband, I don't know if you know this, it was Elia Kazan. And reportedly, Spiegel showed him the scene, the original one, with his wife. And Kazan hated the scene so much, he told Spiegel, who was his friend, to burn the negative. And gosh, this is just all so salacious to me. But Kazan, again, allegedly, was supportive to the Perrys to their faces and supported keeping Loden in the film. And after everything that happened, after Frank was fired, Eleanor Perry really resented that. And she resented that Kazan had misled them and essentially changed the outcome of what happened to them with this movie, because they were fired over not wanting Janice Rule to take over for Loden. Did you know this?
No, that's this could have been a scene in the movie. Is what that sounds like.
Exactly. It's That's just awesome. My jaw dropped when I found this out. And I mean, Elia Kazan was such a heavyweight in Hollywood himself. He did A Streetcar Named Desire, East of Eden. So it's interesting to hear how much power he carried, even with Spiegel. Like, it seems that he had more control than Spiegel, and he wasn't even a producer on the film, right? Crazy. So I just think that this is the scene where things start to properly crumble for Ned. Even the scene that ended up in the movie, it's just really bad. He's also shivering at this point physically. He's super tired, right? And it seems to be colder for him than for Shirley, because she's still in a swimsuit suntanning, right?
Yeah. Even the mood of the environment is colder. When he gets to the boy's house, he starts shivering a little bit. And even at the boy's house, it looked like it was a bit of a cloudy day. And and at the very, very beginning of the movie, he's running through the woods, and we see a lot of trees, and we see a lot of falling leaves. And so this is clearly like beginning of fall. Swimming season's pretty much over. That's why no one, like, I don't think anyone is in the pools until we get to the end. There's like one person falling into a pool. There's one person lounging in the pool.
Yeah.
But these pool parties are not pool parties in the swimming sense. Like, no one wants to swim with him until the final pool. And so he is shivering. It is getting colder in the world, but it's very clear also that there's just something wrong with him. And yes, physically he is tearing down, and it's just getting darker for the guy.
Mm-hmm. And so as things are getting darker for him, and he's at this point just very visibly unwell, let's say, Shirley does offer to drive him home, right? And he refuses. And off he goes again. And now we're reaching near the end, because the last spot before his house is that public pool that he has to swim. And to get to that public pool, he has to cross the highway. And again, keep in mind, he's in his swim trunks, literally, I guess, jaywalking, even worse than jaywalking across the highway. Yeah. Can you imagine driving across a highway and just seeing a dude in his swim trunks bolting across?
Do you know any behind the scenes of that? I feel like multiple wrecks were happening if they didn't shut that down, right? Like,
I have no
idea. Doesn't matter who the actor is, just seeing someone doing that would cause wrecks.
Absolutely. So what I find interesting here, I don't know any behind the scenes information, but I did read the short story. And I found it curious that, actually, first of all, did you read the short story yourself?
I didn't. No, I didn't.
Oh, you did. We do it after this episode. It's very, very quick. Absolutely. But it's interesting that in the short story, I think people were driving across in their cars, they were yelling at him and they were throwing things. Mm-hmm. And I wonder why they softened the blow a bit in the movie, because they made it dangerous. Mm. Yeah, but he wasn't getting trash thrown at him.
No. There's one kid that did it. And, I wonder if they filmed it, because there was actually a lot of trash I noticed by him. So I wonder if they filmed a ton of it. But one kid did, for sure. It's very obvious. And it was a kid. But no one was yelling. And it's cut in a way. It's edited so quickly as well. So cameras are moving as fast as the cars are. And it's blurry. And it's an absolute nightmare of a situation for him. And they edited it exactly as it's probably experienced.
Totally. And then that nightmare just gets even worse, because then he gets to the public pool, right? And he's still shivering at this point. He's like dirty. And again, he obviously doesn't have money to get in, because he's in the swim trunks. So where would this money be, right? Even if he had some. So he's begging to be let in. Some of his neighbors come up and in the line behind him, and he asks them for these 50 cents for entry. And the male neighbor gives him the money, but not before his wife, or I think it's his wife, she scolds him because she knows, right? Something's up. So he makes it in, and then we get this funny segment, or to me it was funny. The guy who monitors the access into the pools, he makes him go shower and wash his feet twice because he's just so filthy. I mean, did you notice at that point, he like gets him to like peel apart his toes the second time? It's so gross.
He was really strict on him, but also I was grossed out by just the public shower where he uses the public soap. That was, I was like, no. And because I have memories of public pools. I grew up going to some public pools. And it's the amount of times we had to get out of there because something happened.
It's
awful. Just the memories flooded back, and I was like, no, this is the worst.
Especially that little piece of soap. I was just like gagging internally.
Yeah.
So he makes it into this packed pool, literally packed, like filled to the brim. And he somehow swims across. He's just like ingesting all this chlorine water. And don't ask how, but he makes it out. And it's that couple again from the line, from the queue, with their friends, and they start berating him, full on berating him, making fun of him that he's at this, that he's this quote unquote well off man swimming in a public pool. And here we get more hints that, or I guess not even hints at this point, now it's becoming obvious that his business failed. And we discover that these people aren't as affluent as he is. I think they're owners of businesses of some sort that Ned bought from, and he owes them money, and now he's been dodging them. And this is also where we discover that his daughters may not be the angels that he portrayed, because we hear something about that drunk driving, right? Is there anything I'm missing here?
No, that's about right. Like they, that scene ends with something about his daughters, but yeah, before that, it's very clear that, well, first off, these are the first people in this entire movie. And this is the class. This is the difference in class. These are the first people that just tell them what's up and tell us, the viewers, what's up. We don't get all the answers, but it's very clear that, this guy was living on top of the hill and definitely not anymore. And these people were just as affected, just as not as well off as he currently is. He just doesn't realize that he is at this point probably equals or worse than the people that he's currently talking to. So, yeah, I don't know who these people are. He mentioned something about giving baseball tickets to the guy. So like he obviously knows who they are. They obviously know who he is. I don't know the relationship, but at the end, the guy who was kind of rooting for him, kind of being nice when the other three were berating him, just flat out is tired of Bert not just realizing he's in the wrong. And he just straight up says, by the way, your daughters laugh at you. They don't respect you. And he would constantly be like, my daughters respect me. They love me. And the guy was just like, no, you're wrong. And that obviously threw him for a loop.
Yeah, he spirals there. And that's an interesting point you make, that they're the first people who tell him how it is, Because you're right, and I didn't notice that that they are the first people that are not from this same sort of class that he's in that tell him what's up, and that's what ruins him. And it is kind of heartbreaking, I think, weirdly enough, because you have all this pent up emotion that you're feeling throughout the entire movie, and when they break the news that his daughters don't even like them, even me as a viewer, I was like, ouch, that sucks.
Yeah.
And so he's getting berated and he runs away literally up a hill. And now he's walking towards his final destination, which is his house. And as he's walking closer and closer to the house, the weather gets worse. This is where things start getting, there's a bit of that surrealism, right? Where he gets to the front gate and it's a storm. It's an actual storm. And as he tries opening the front gate, it's covered in rust. And he makes his way to that famed tennis court that he was talking about that his daughters were allegedly playing at. Clearly, it hasn't been used in God knows how long. We hear the faint echoes of their laughs, memories, I guess. And he gets to the front door and he just crumbles to the ground. The door is locked. And then we get that haunting final scene that pans into his house through the window, which is, of course, empty and abandoned. And we hear Ned's wails and that score again. And just all the romance of the score is gone. And it's pure tragedy. What did you think now when everything made sense to you?
Yeah. Yeah. I still no answers, which is the really crazy thing is, but I love it. You know, I love like not having my hand held. And that's what makes, I think that's what makes for a great film is the discussion you get to have afterwards. You know, the movie never ends when the credits roll. It continues because you're talking with your friends, and this is a great one to do that because what the heck, what happened? Exactly. I want to know, but I loved the transition from being outside the house, panning to the broken window. And then we see, just the bare inside of the house in a really haunting frame, like just empty and sad. And there's some tennis rackets and some boxes. And yeah, I mean, it's obviously been a while with the rusted gates there. And like it is very clear that he is delusional, having like a midlife crisis of just not remembering the past couple of years of trauma.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I mean, ultimately, it's just a movie that's incredibly tragic, no matter what Ned is like himself as a character. But it is about a man who sees his life one way. He's telling everyone how it is. And yet that's just so different from his reality, right? And I think Lancaster is incredible in that final scene because we were saying earlier on, he's this tall guy, he's very confident. And to see him curl up and break down. And if you've seen his other movies, let's take Sweet Smell of Success, for example. He's right, totally different. So just to see Lancaster to be so raw and exposed in the end, I think it makes for a really impactful and haunting ending, in my opinion. I don't know if you've read the liner notes in the physical copy, but Stuart Gordon, who's a great filmmaker in his own right, he wrote the notes and he mentioned something interesting that Ned may be a ghost. Is this something that ever crossed your mind? Because it didn't for me.
100%, actually.
Really?
I fully expected not like a ghost in the sense of like a sixth sense situation. It's very obvious that he exists. People do know him, but the way that he floats from one place to another is very ethereal, very almost spiritual. There's one from one pool to the other, he dives in and then comes out of someone else's pool, and it's almost as if he is traveling through water only, as if he is bound to the water, like a ghost bound to a location. And so I fully expect, not fully, but I definitely expected a weirder turn. And I'm not disappointed that it didn't, but I was just like, okay, there is something very wrong here. Either he's dead, his family's dead. There's something up because Because of the way that he just moves through the space.
Yeah, that's clever. Yeah, it didn't cross my mind, but now that you mention it in the way that it was edited from pool to pool, it does make me think so as well. But interestingly, for that final scene, after those reshoots with Pollock, there was, again, allegedly, an alternate ending, which was a happy ending. And that's where Shirley, the ex-mistress, she drives up to the house and she takes Ned away with her. And the Perrys hated it because they saw it. And I think Eleanor said something like, I think I wrote it down. Yeah. Ned Merrill's desperate journey no longer ended in emptiness, loneliness, and madness. And she hated that. And thank God the alternate ending wasn't used, because I think it would have totally ruined the movie. Don't you agree?
Yeah, because then what's it all for?
Exactly. If,
you get to do whatever you want, because you're just going to be bailed out. So, yeah, that absolutely. Yeah.
Thank God. So, to wrap up on The Swimmer, the finished film was released in May of 1968, May 15th, I believe. It did not perform well at all. I heard some theories that this was due to the time that it was released, because this idea of masculinity in pop culture was in a transitional period, much like how movies were in Hollywood as well. So people just didn't know what to make of it. And I think it's a movie that will either grip you or it won't. And for me, I mean, I was captivated by this. And I think the power lies at the core from Cheever's brilliant story, but then also Eleanor Perry, who took it and added so much more meat to it. I just think it's fantastic. I mean, what are your final thoughts on it?
Yeah. It's wonderful, and I'm glad you exist in this space, because it definitely would, it would have never come across my radar, but it is so important to constantly talk about the films from our past, because, or you'll just never watch great art, and, you know, it's not the greatest movie in the entire world. Obviously there's 99% of movies is that, right? But it is still very special. It's clear. Like I get why Bert loves it so much, for him, for his, like it being his favorite. Mm-hmm. And it totally fits in the things that I enjoy about just the weirdness of the suburbs. You know, we've talked about like the Arcade Fire album. It just, you know, even Edward Scissorhands, that like there's something about just these people trapped in these glass windows of judgments and rumors and wrongdoings everywhere, and once you're out of that door, it's all smiles and we're all at the pool party, we're all having fun. Meanwhile everyone has dirt on everyone, and every time there's a movie that is set in the suburbs, I just feel like that's what's happening, unless it's like a comedy or whatever. Yeah, there's something just really weird about it, and yeah, so it fits. It fits in my collection for sure.
I love it. Well, that's almost all that we have time for today. But I was hoping that you could do a couple of things for me. For one, I really want you to highlight your current TikTok series about your personal collection, because I think everybody should know about it before I get my butt on eBay and start doing my own shopping. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's this weird, like, I'm obsessed with physical media. It is so important to me. But I'm currently in a space and time where I want to get rid of like half of it. And even though I haven't been successful at that aspect of my series, the full series being that I'm just kind of selling my stuff to get out of debt, which again, just like watching The Swimmer, it's like, yeah, okay, I see. I know what pool I'm going to right now. but movies, my collection is very much a part of that. And, it just became too much. It's too much of something. And instead I want to focus on better releases, basically. So this is, I specifically got this one because it has the slipcover. This is beautiful. This is absolutely wonderful, and something that must be kept. Whereas, you know, some of the DVDs from back in the day can go. So I like, please, everyone, buy physical media because it's the most important thing.
Yes.
But at the same time, I'm going to cut back a little bit myself, you know? So it's like, it's this weird thing, but I think people understand when I explain my outlook at it all. But
totally.
Yeah.
I think you're allowed a break from buying considering how big your collection is. But lastly, where can these lovely folks find you online for more of your work and your thoughts? Any links at all?
Yeah, just B-Star, star with two R's, cinema, B-Star cinema. My name is Brian. I got my little childhood from the 80s Brian name there. So anywhere you see that, you'll see me, because I've kind of created, that's part of my branding now, which I just love. But yeah, B-Star cinema, pretty much across the board, mostly on TikTok right now. I do love my Instagram stories. I think everyone says this, but I think YouTube is definitely on the horizon as well. I have one and have had one since 2006 and love it. But I do think, I want to tell longer stories instead of, you know, 2 minutes at a time. And so, the nice thing is I've snatched all the usernames for B-Star Cinema. So that's where you can find me.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on today, and I would be honored to have you back.
Of course. This is, like I said, this is a dream come true, and I know it is for you as well. I'm so honored to be in the first wave here.
Likewise. And
look forward to seeing it all. Yeah.
Thank you, Brian. Have a good one. Bye.
All right. Bye.
Okay, we're done. A Capital G Media production. McFly's Movie House is produced by Ghazal El-Hayi and Carmen Fong. Our music is Chunky Monkey by Stryker Big Band. If you enjoyed today's conversation, be sure to leave a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you want to go above and beyond, please be sure to share on socials. I'm Marta Georgievich, and make sure to come over every Monday to McFly's Movie House for all things cinema, film, and creative. Until then, stay safe and stay curious.